2003. This is the House Water Committee. We are in session now, and the first item on the agenda is the adoption as a committee bill of LC 2226. The chair moves the adoption of this as a committee bill and would ask the members for their support, telling the members and ensuring the members at the time that their support in introducing this as a committee bill in no way obligates them to a yea or nay on the passage of the bill at a later date. Merely that it is introduced so that it gets the hearing that it isn't would otherwise be entitled to. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, what are we trying to achieve with this legislation?
We have a witness here that would maybe enlighten us
Good.
A little bit. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Ashkin today representing the Oregon Agriculture Alliance. This measure is essentially a housekeeping measure that cleans up a minor administrative rule problem with the Willamette Basin program that was adopted in 1992 by the Water Resources Commission. At that time, as a provision of the Willamette Basin program, the Water Resource Commission adopted a kind of an odd five-year renewable water permit for groundwater limited areas in the Willamette Basin. And this five-year renewable permit is not deemed by some to be wholly consistent with statutory water law. The department has had a problem with administering these five-year renewable permits. They've been in effect in the groundwater limited areas of the Willamette Valley for approximately 11 to 12 years. And they don't have administrative rules which guide the department on how to process these water rights, because they differ from other groundwater permits so significantly. There are only 50 such five-year permits in the Willamette Basin, and they are all located in groundwater limited areas, and I've attached a map of all of the groundwater limited areas to our testimony. All this bill would do is to just convert those permits to regular permits subject to proof and certification so that the department then has clear guidance on how to identify whether the reservoir can sustain continued use of the resource in those areas and approve the permits and let them go on to final proof survey and certification, or deny the permits if the resource won't sustain continued use. So that's all the bill does. It's really quite a minor bill. Only affects about 50 people in the Willamette Basin.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears that we need to go.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want us to save our questions for later, or should we?
Yeah. We're really not debating the bill.
Okay. Go ahead. This morning.
Thank you. Is there any objection to introducing it as a committee bill? Hearing none, so ordered. At this point, the chair and vice chair need to go to testify on another committee. We'll turn the gavel over to Representative Cruz and proceed with the informational meeting that we have scheduled.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair, I will do that. Going to open an informational meeting, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality update, and first up is Mike Llewellyn. First up and second up, I believe, so.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Llewellyn. I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Division with the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you very much for the opportunity to spend a significant amount of time today talking about the Federal Clean Water Act. I'm going to provide a very hopefully comprehensive overview of the Federal Clean Water Act, and in the process of doing that, what I hope to do for you is to put into context some of the issues that I know that you've been talking about in previous sessions, and likely we'll get into more detail this session. Things such as water quality standards, you've heard about the 303D list, and certainly we've talked about TMDLs, but sometimes when we come before you and talk about any of those issues individually, you may be missing the broader context of how they interrelate within the context of the Federal Clean Water Act. So what I hope to do today is to walk you through a bit of the history of the Act, what are the major components of the Act, and I've put in my presentation some graphics that might help show how on a real-world basis this Act actually operates here in Oregon as well as nationally. The Federal Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, and it was passed in the era where there was a substantial amount of federal environmental legislation, such as the Clean Air Act. These are the goals of the Act. I've just taken right out of it. It's kind of interesting looking back 30 years ago where Congress was at that point in time. The main goal, of course, is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. I underscored the physical and biological part of that primarily because a lot of people think about the Clean Water Act, or think even about clean water as being water chemistry, that if the water itself is pure, that you have accomplished what you need in terms of meeting our societal goals of water. But as we know, you can have essentially very clean water chemistry, but if you don't have good habitat, you may not be able, obviously, to support aquatic life or fish. Conversely, you could have very good habitat in terms of riparian or streamside vegetation, the geomorphology of streams, but the chemistry is bad and there's no dissolved oxygen in the water, or you have toxics or bacteria. That impacts other uses of water. So the Act in itself is very comprehensive in that it looks at water quality very broadly in terms of chemistry, physical aspects, and biological health of streams.
Mike, wasn't it true a couple years ago that Hyundai was having a problem with their discharge because it was too clean? I mean, it's almost like it had nothing in it. I remember that. I remember that being a problem, or being reported as a problem, that, I mean, it had nothing in it. I mean, and that can, you know, when you have a discharge of the volume they were doing, that could almost be too clean and be diluting everything that's supposed to be in the water.
I'm not aware of that, Mr. Chair, but certainly, as we'll talk about the temperature standard, of course, which is a water quality standard that's been of a lot of interest, as you know. There are situations where actually, despite all the debate about whether how warm water needs or can be in terms of impairing fish, there are situations where actually water can be too cold. When, let's say, you have a dam storage or reservoirs and the release of cold water, the time, you know, vis-a-vis the timing of fish migration or spawning can throw off the natural situation. So I'd be glad to check into that Hyundai situation, but I'm not personally aware of it. It's also interesting that the goal of the Act, again passed in 1972, was that the discharge of pollutants to the nation's waters be eliminated in 1985, and that we have an interim goal for all of our waters to be, quote, fishable and swimmable by 1983. So this was the fundamental goal of the Clean Water Act as it was adopted in 1972. And I'll talk a little bit about why we are obviously far short of meeting that fundamental goal of zero discharge of pollutants into our nation's waters. The foundation of the act is the adoption of water quality standards. Water quality standards are basically the benchmark that we're trying to attain when, to know when do we have clean water for the uses that we have water for. States were required to adopt beneficial or designated uses in the early 70s. These are just examples that come out of our standards. It's not all-inclusive, but we identify water bodies as being used for public drinking water supply, obviously. Salmonid spawning is a use here in Oregon. Hydropower, irrigation, there's recreational use. Obviously, we use water for multiple purposes, and we assign, when we say a water body, as an example, is going to be used for salmonid spawning, you have to then identify what are the characteristics of the water that would support salmonid spawning. What are the characteristics of water to support irrigation? What are the characteristics of water if we want it for a public drinking water supply? How we do that is by the adoption of water quality standards, which identify those benchmarks. Water quality standards, and I'm going to give you some examples, are not absolutes. In other words, if you have a particular standard, if you're a little bit higher than that standard, it does not imply that all the fish are going to die. It doesn't imply that if you drink the water, you're going to get violently sick. It doesn't mean that if you fall in the water and there's bacteria in it that you're going to get sick. But those thresholds do or are based on the best science available at the time that would indicate that you've gone above basically a risk level where you've increased the risk of those various things happening. Conversely, just because you're better than the standard doesn't always necessarily mean that you are protective or you're protecting all those uses. One of the reasons for that is we have probably around 250 to 300 various water quality standards. Those standards typically are developed at a national level, and they are evaluated individually. EPA looks at cyanide or arsenic or heavy metals or biological oxygen demand in the context of what that pollutant would do in the water. The science of looking at synergistic effects of having water that might have some standards that are higher and some standards are lower is not very well understood. So this whole concept of being above a number or below a number, being safe or not safe, is much more complex than meets the eye. Standards can change, and they do change all the time. Obviously, when we adopted standards in 1972, we used whatever the science was around those numbers then. EPA is constantly evaluating the best science around whatever pollutant we're talking about. We actually, as all states, are required to update standards every 3 years, or at least look at whether we should update standards every 3 years to take into account changes in science. We also take into account that maybe a number that was adopted or recommended nationally may not be appropriate here in Oregon. Sometimes the species that are used in laboratories to study the effects of a particular pollutant may not even be present in a particular state. It may not be the most sensitive species. So there's also regional issues that EPA may not take into consideration, and states have the opportunity, they're not necessarily required to, but they have the opportunity to adopt standards that are different than what EPA may recommend. But from a starting point, we usually look at what the science has been promoted by EPA, and then we have a process to evaluate those standards.
Mike, would it be possible to get a side-by-side comparison of EPA standards and DEQ standards?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
absolutely. As a matter of fact, Mr. Chair, we are a couple of months away from coming out with some recommended changes to our toxic standards. We have many, many toxic standards, and we actually have a table already built that will do that exact comparison for you. And also would have the rationale, if we are proposing not to adopt a federal number, why not? What's the underlying public policy that we're trying to get at in terms of that number? I've just picked a few standards here as examples to walk you through what a standard is and what it means. Standards can, or criteria can be numeric. In other words, they can be expressed as a number. An example is 11 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen in the water. Dissolved oxygen is very important for aquatic life and fish. They need oxygen just like we do. This particular level is identified as a necessary protective level for salmonid species. Again, I want to stress it doesn't mean if the water is 10 milligrams per liter that the fish are going to go belly up. It doesn't mean that if the dissolved oxygen is higher than that, everything's great. It's a risk-based threshold, but it's viewed as protective enough that we might adopt a standard like that. Standards and criteria can also be expressed as acute and chronic. Here I've identified, as an example, cyanide. 22 micrograms per liter of cyanide is a level that in most situations would be lethal to aquatic life, whereas 5.2 micrograms per liter might be chronic, have a chronic problem. In other words, if a fish is exposed to 22 micrograms per liter, that might be close to a lethal level. If they're constantly in water that is above 5.2 but below 11 or below 22, they might see, instead of lethality, impacts on their reproduction or growth or disease vulnerability. It wouldn't be enough to kill them necessarily, but it might lead to other problems. I often get asked the difference between numbers for human protection versus aquatic life. Here's another example of cadmium, where the aquatic life are more sensitive to heavy metals like cadmium than human beings are. We can tolerate more cadmium in our drinking water over our lifetime than aquatic species can. So what does that mean in the real world? It means that if we are adopting a cadmium number in a particular stream and there's aquatic species in that stream, which of course in most cases there are, the 1.1 microgram per liter cadmium number would be the driving number from a regulatory standpoint to protect the most sensitive use. We also have water quality criteria or standards, excuse me, that are narrative, meaning we don't identify a number. This quote I have here has been on the books probably for 30 years. It must have been adopted when either the Sanitary Commission or DEQ originally adopted standards. Bacterial pollution or other conditions deleterious to waters used for domestic purposes, livestock watering, irrigation, bathing, or shellfish propagation, or otherwise injurious to public health shall not be allowed. Now, obviously, the downside to a narrative standard is, if I'm imagining everybody on the committee might ask, well, what does that mean? Exactly, and that's the problem with the narrative standard. You read it, and it gives us, in essence, the authority to go out and say, we're seeing a bacteria problem in this stream that we believe is causing an impact, let's say, to livestock watering. But the obvious question we would get is, do we absolutely know the cause and effect? At what level of bacteria is safe? And over time, we have been forced or chosen ourselves to move more and more away from narrative standards to numeric standards because folks want more certainty than just reading a narrative approach. But we still have narrative standards on the books. We also have standards that include both numeric and narrative, and this, the temperature standard is the exact situation here. I know that there have been a lot of people who have said that our temperature standard is numeric, that we're trying to get all streams to meet 64 degrees or 55 degrees for spawning. In fact, the standard does not say that. The 64 degrees or the 55 degrees is a threshold at which, if the stream is above that, we begin to look at whether or not that is a natural condition or it is caused by man-caused or human-caused problems, and we try to figure out what is the closest we can get to the natural temperature profile of that particular stream. So in essence, we used in the temperature standard a numeric trigger, but then if you actually read through the standard, which is quite lengthy, admittedly, you'll see it has a lot of narrative components that address things such as natural conditions, geographic variability, and acknowledge, in essence, that not all streams can, will, or ever have been at that particular threshold. But we put that number in the standard so it begins the process of identifying the evaluation. And I'm going to show you later how this works when we get into TMDLs and how we eventually figure out what a temperature profile of a stream would be. Well, when we evaluate streams and water bodies under the Clean Water Act every 2 years, one of the things that states are required to do is to identify water bodies that are not meeting these standards that I'm talking about. This is the so-called 303D list, 303D referring to a section of the Clean Water Act. All states are required to turn in this list to EPA. EPA must approve or deny or conditionally approve the list. Ultimately, it basically is a list of water bodies that do not meet standards and are not expected to meet standards in the next 2 years before the next listing comes through. I would look at it essentially as the TMDL, and I'll talk about TMDLs, to-do list. It triggers when we start to evaluate water bodies. Water bodies can come off the 303D list for a number of reasons. One is when a TMDL is actually approved by EPA once we submit it. And I'll go into more detail, Mr. Chair, later on the specifics of the 303D list, but we just recently submitted our 2002 list to EPA, and we are delisting about 6,000 stream miles in the state of Oregon, the vast majority of that because of approved TMDLs that have occurred since the last listing. We go through a very intensive process when we do the 303D list. People submit data to us. It's not just DEQ's data. We take data from watershed councils, federal agencies, private organizations. They have to submit data that's quality assured, obviously. But we also get data that says maybe the original listing was based on bad data or inaccurate data, and we'll delist. Maybe the standards have changed since the last 303D list, and that can be a double-edged sword. The standard may have changed. It's going to put more water bodies on the list, or maybe the standard changed. We're going to delist water bodies now because the original standard was not appropriate. We have about 13,000 stream miles in Oregon on the current list. I've got a breakout slide later that shows you of what parameters we're talking about. That reflects about 10% of the mapped stream miles in the state and water bodies in the state of Oregon. Just in terms of the context, there's about 130,000 mapped stream miles in the state of Oregon. What's important there, Mr. Chair, is that includes both perennial streams that have water going in them literally 12 months of the year, but it also includes streams mapped by the U.S. Geological Survey that may have water in them only a couple of months of the year, but nevertheless, they're natural waterways.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Thank you. The 10% that you mentioned, would you repeat that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, I'm actually going to have a slide later that will have those numbers, but just while it's fresh in your mind, there's approximately 130,000 stream and river miles in the state of Oregon.
Right.
13,000 of those river miles are on the 303D list,
thank
so
you.
It's about 10%.
That's what I wanted. Thank you.
Okay.
Some of these stream miles don't run all year round.
Correct.
And then what's your cutoff point for how many days or months that they do run before they're on this list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't think there is a cutoff per se other than when we look at the designation of a water body. If a water body is only running a couple of months a year, in our standards, we may acknowledge that it is not a salmonid spawning stream, as an example, because if it's only running, let's say, in fall when we get, or early spring when you're getting a lot of rain, and it's not designated as a salmonid spawning, then the 303D list wouldn't be triggered necessarily. That said, a lot of the designations in the state were done 30 years ago, and we did not. I wasn't around. I was alive then, but I wasn't around at DEQ then. But I don't know. My sense is that the amount of effort that went into physically walking 130,000 street miles obviously didn't happen. And so we were very aware of the fact that there are water bodies on designated in this state that may be designated inappropriately. And that gets into a process called use attainability analysis under the Clean Water Act, which is basically a mechanism to go in and say the original designation of a water body, let's say as a salmonid-bearing stream, is not feasible. It never was. It may have been listed as or designated as a stream, but because of the fact that my predecessors just essentially took the data that they had 30 years ago, it's inaccurate, and now that we have better information, we pull that stream off the designation of salmonid spawning and may just characterize it as an ephemeral stream that might have use for irrigation or some other short-term use, not a long-term use like salmon.
Would it be safe to say that all 13,000 miles that are listed are flowing more than...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, most of them are. excuse me. Non-point sources of pollution, terminology-wise, you may hear the term point sources, and I'm going to actually get into some graphics to talk about this, but a point source, for all intents and purposes, is pollution that's coming out of a pipe. It's pollution that's coming out of an industry or a municipality. Non-point source pollution is essentially everything else. It tends to be pollution that's associated with runoff from rain or snow events. It's both rural and urban in nature. It can include, as an example, runoff of city streets, runoff from highways, runoff from farm fields, runoff from timber operations, essentially any type of pollution that is not dispersed through a discrete conveyance like a pipe. In 1987, Congress revised the Clean Water Act and added Section 319. Section 319 is not a regulatory part of the Clean Water Act. It is, in essence, a grant program. It required states to identify how they are managing non-point source pollution. We get about $3.2 million a year from EPA under this provision of the Clean Water Act. Most of that money is passed through in grants. I believe at the last meeting I got a question about the 319 program, so I provided some follow-up information to you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. But what Congress, I think, was starting to recognize in the mid-80s is that nationally we had made tremendous progress in terms of managing point source pollution. We weren't there yet in terms of meeting all stream segments being clean, obviously, and we still aren't. But there was a greater recognition that we were not going to attain the goals of the Clean Water Act if we focused solely on point source pollution, because a lot of water bodies are impacted and impaired because of non-point source pollution, whether it's coming from, again, urban runoff, or it's coming from agriculture and forestry or other rural or landscape-driven pollution sources. So I'm going to get in some hopefully...
Before we move off there, just kind of a point, because a lot of national standards, especially if we're dealing in things like this, kind of based on events that occur on a regular basis more in the Midwest than they do here. And clearly, non-point would be a different critter in Ohio than it would be in Oregon, obviously, where everything's private owned and everything mostly is agriculture, and they do have some significant problems, whereas here we're 50% federal. And clearly different types of watersheds. So I guess I just kind of want to make that point that you know, we kind of get sometimes captured in a system that doesn't fit us very well necessarily.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the definition of non-point source is very broad, and it would include non-point source problems coming off of federal lands. I worked about 11 years in the state of Wisconsin as an example, and you're absolutely right. There's not a lot of federal land ownership there. But from a characteristic standpoint, I mean, essentially what we're looking at is the stream impaired because of some runoff of pollutants from whatever source, whether it's BLM or it's a private...
Right, but our ability as a state to... to require management practice on federal land is somewhat limited. So,
yes,
so you know, it narrows what we can actually do here compared to a state that's mostly private ownership.
Mr. Chair, actually, that's a very good point. And there are provisions in the Clean Water Act, Section 313 specifically, that require federal agencies who basically create pollution problems, including the land management agencies, to meet state water quality standards. Now, admittedly, there is not a lot of case law or real specific interaction with federal agencies to see how far that provision of the Act is pushed. We have several memorandums of agreement with BLM, the U.S. Forest Service, specifically looking at what they do under their various programs to meet state water quality standards. So there is a nexus between the state and federal agencies, but you're correct, it's a very different institutional relationship between a private farmer or forester and a federal land management agency, yeah. Clearly.
And the out that the federal agencies have is 313 may say they have to do it, but if the funding doesn't come, then they don't.
That may be correct, Mr. Chair. That's right.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go back to point source management?
Mm-hmm.
Point source. There we go. Right. Okay, can you talk a little bit more about each of those bullets?
Oh, I just realized I must have skipped right
well,
over
I'm
that.
I'm so glad you said that. I thought, did I fall asleep?
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, you did, Representative, but we weren't going to say anything.
No, she didn't.
Fingers got ahead of me. Point sources, yes. And this is where I'm going to show you after I describe this graphics of how this works. Point sources are, as I said, discrete conveyances coming out of pipes. Remember that this act was passed in 1972, and I think it was, 4 years after we had put some people on the moon. I think our country was very enamored with technology. So the Federal Clean Water Act, essentially, if you go back to the goal of no pollutants discharged in 1985, which was 13 years out from when it was passed, I think that Congress felt very comfortable that we had the technology and the economics of the technology were such that we could eliminate pollution coming out of pipes, at least. The mechanism of the Clean Water Act is that all point sources have what are called, as a starting point, what are called categorical effluent limits. What that really means is if you take any type of a industrial sector, let's take a pulp mill, the fundamental requirements of how much pollution a pulp mill must treat are the same in Oregon as they are in Georgia, as they are in Maine, anywhere in the country. It's a level playing field argument. They have to treat to the exact same level. Now, I'm going to show you in a graphic that ultimately where that facility is located has a tremendous impact on whether or not water quality standards are met, and I'll show you that. But this concept of technology limits was to avoid the term that was used at the time was river shopping, where we didn't want a situation where a particular state may be more willing to take a pulp mill than another state because of just for whatever dynamic. And Congress said all pulp mills or all electroplaters or a lot of different industrial sectors must have the same fundamental treatment requirement regardless of where they are. The same thing for municipalities. All municipalities who discharge into surface waters have a fundamental starting point of what's called secondary treatment. It's about a 90% removal of the pollutants that go into a treatment plant. Again, it doesn't matter where you are in this country, municipalities all start with secondary treatment as a fundamental requirement. What we get into, however, is, and this is where the graphics will come in, those fundamental minimum levels of treatment may not be protective enough to meet water quality standards depending on which stream you discharge into. You discharge into the Pacific Ocean versus a small tributary of the Willamette, you take the same facility, you have very, very different impacts on water quality. And that eventually is how we get into the TMDL dynamics that I'll show you. This is all managed through, you may have heard this terminology, NPDES permits. It's the wastewater permits that DEQ issues. That's where we put in these fundamental requirements for municipalities or industries treat their wastewater to these bottom line minimal efforts. If those efforts are not good enough on a particular stream, then we develop what are called water quality based effluent limits, which basically means more stringent sufficient limits to actually meet the site-specific requirement of that particular stream.
Why we're there, just kind of a curiosity, you know, with Portland's new stormwater system that's still being created, I believe, we are taking a lot of indiscrete sources and making them a discrete source, obviously, because things that flowed wherever are now going to be point source. From your perspective, are you focused on the treatment aspect or I mean, it's kind of like, you know, urban runoff is non-point to a degree. Okay, but then it becomes point source at a point in time. And so I guess from your perspective, you're dealing with treatment and not source in that sort of scenario?
Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing that point. That's a very good point. In the early 1990s, EPA promulgated regulations related to urban stormwater. So, there's a threshold here that we're talking about. It started with all municipalities in the country that had 100,000 people or more in population were required, that the city was required to get, in addition to traditional domestic sewage permits for treatment plants, permits to deal with stormwater runoff. Last year, EPA dropped those thresholds to now communities of 10,000 or above must get essentially a wastewater permit related to urban stormwater runoff. All communities below that are not required to get a permit. So the gray area between dealing with stuff coming out of a pipe, meaning for most people, meaning the stuff in your house that you flush down your toilet or it comes out of your sink or businesses that discharge into a system, that was pretty clear to people, but now we are getting this gray area of urban stormwater being captured under the point source program. Now, let me talk about Portland for a moment. Many municipalities, older municipalities in this country, have what are called combined sewers. A combined sewer, you know, if you think about it, actually I think that these large municipalities were actually trying to do the right thing in that most municipalities, whatever comes out of your house comes out of if you're in a sewer community, comes out of a lateral from your house into a smaller sewer that's in your street, and that runs down to a larger sewer somewhere that then eventually goes to a treatment plant. What's in that pipe is essentially domestic sewage or gray water from your house, or if a business or commercial establishment is in your city, it goes into that sewer. The point being that what is in that sewer is sewage and industrial and commercial waste. Larger cities like Portland, Seattle, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Miami, big cities, in the older parts of those cities often built what are called combined sewers. They're very large sewers that take all the stuff from your houses and the businesses and the commercial establishments, but also took stormwater, maybe connected from roof drains or just what's running off of the street. That water, in essence, when it went to the treatment plant, was treated. So you were, in Portland, actually treating some of the urban stormwater runoff. The problem is, of course, as these municipalities grew, either they had a bottleneck at the treatment plant where during high rain events that treatment plant cannot handle all of the stormwater now and domestic sewage going to that treatment facility, or the infrastructure itself was just constrained. You also have a phenomenon with these very old combined sewers being very leaky, and you have groundwater infiltration again in the winter when the groundwater table comes up. They're just dealing with too much water. So these combined sewers are very different from a sewer that's in most municipalities. And what a lot of these communities are doing, like Portland, is having to make a fundamental choice. One is you go in and you, quote, separate the sewers. You dig up the street, you go in, and you put two sewers in the ground now. One that's a traditional domestic sewage to go to the treatment plant. The other is the street runoff that's going to go to a stream. Now, 20 years ago, everybody thought sewer separation is a great idea, but now that we're more aware of the impacts of urban stormwater in terms of what's on the street, just running a pipe from the street to the river doesn't make much sense either. So a lot of cities now are, in lieu of separating sewers, they're building storage capacity so that as that rain event subsides, the treatment plant, when it comes online again, can take that stored water. Portland, in essence, literally today, is tunneling about 100 to 200 feet under the west bank of the Willamette River, a massive, I can't remember the diameter, Mr. Chair, but it's 15 to 20 feet tunnel. It's going to run for miles. This is the same projects that Chicago has, Milwaukee, many communities. So what they're doing in lieu of separating the sewer is they're building more storage capacity to still take that rain event and the sewage, wait for the, you know, the capacity of the treatment plant to come up, and then they're going to run that stuff through the treatment plant. A lot of communities also are expanding their treatment plant as well. So 30 years after the Clean Water Act, some of these large cities, yes, they still are in the midst of dealing with raw sewage overflows. Actually, a lot of cities that don't have combined sewers also have bypasses because, again, they got behind in keeping up with their infrastructure. They got leaky sewers. Maybe they've added more residences and businesses, etc. And in really high rain events, the treatment plant can't take it. In lieu of backing it up into people's basements, they turn the valve and out it goes. But we've got a lot of these communities under orders or provisions to fix that problem, and Portland's no different. They've been under order for 10 years to invest in the treatment capacity of combined sewers. So the evolution of the Clean Water Act, and then I'm going to get into my graphics. Looking back over the last 30 years, we really, in this country, focused on conventional pollutants, meaning this is the kind of stuff that you may have just heard about or saw the 30-second news clip of the pretty ugly-looking stuff coming out of pipes, the so-called death of Lake Erie, the Cuyahoga River catching on fire, the Willamette story. We focused on the organic material that came out of sewage and treatment plants and industrial facilities and did a great job of cleaning that stuff up. That basically restored the water chemistry to a certain degree, where dissolved oxygen started to come back, and some streams that didn't have fish in them came back. The fish were back. The bad news was the fish had lesions and tumors, and they were inedible. This started to happen in the mid-1980s. Why? Toxics. We were not focused on, we didn't know a lot about low levels of toxics in wastewater. I mean, certainly people are aware of it, but we didn't realize that the effect that toxics were having on fish and aquatic life. So in about the mid-1980s, states and EPA started now to focus less on the conventional pollution, just the organic material, and now what's happening with toxics. That's, again, another reason why in the mid-1980s there was kind of a rejuvenation of looking at the Clean Water Act and this recognition that even if we cleaned up toxics from point sources, we still had a lot of water bodies in the country that we needed to deal with the non-point source problem. This is where the TMDL program really became more central, because TMDLs, I'm going to walk you through those, is the place where we try to get at this equitable distribution of what's causing water quality problems in these streams, how much of it is point source, how much of it is non-point source, and who needs to step up to deal with the problem.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crump.
Doug, before you go, Doug, why do I always want to do that?
I think he's the guy, Mr. Chair, yeah. On the... I'm not related to him. I know you're talking.
I know. I'm sorry, Mike.
That's all right.
They don't even look alike.
Well, apparently they do in my mind, because I keep making that Freudian slip for some stupid reason. You're talking about toxic and toxics and fish deformity. In your mind, has the conclusive science been promulgated out there and reviewed, and it's broadly accepted in the scientific community that toxics are causing the fish deformities? Because I know we have the issue up here in the Newburgh Pool, and we don't know what is doing that.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Crop, I think there's a pretty good body of science that says, you know, at toxic levels, fish will have some type of impact. Obviously, there will be impact on fish. But with regard to the Newburgh Pool, I think the jury is still out. I know that OSU was given a contract through the OEB process to continue some work that DEQ had been doing in the early 90s to try to figure out what's causing the skeletal deformities. My understanding, Representative Krupp, is still inconclusive. I think statistically they know that there's something anomalous with the Newburgh Pool. It's different than skeletal deformities elsewhere in the system. But in terms of the cause and effect, whether it's genetic or a different genetic issue, or it's bacterial, or it's pollution, or it's synergistic, I think they still don't know.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Well, now I'm going to hopefully, by using some graphics, put this into a better context for you. So I've just got a, starting with kind of a sample watershed here. I get this little pen to work. As I walk you through, obviously I've got sort of graphically what I want you to think of as a very large water body here with a lot of volume, a pretty good sized main stem of a river, and then these little tributaries that would have, you know, less flow in them essentially as I walk you through this.
And that looks like a genetically altered fish too.
I don't know if he's trying to get out or he's happy.
Okay.
So let's start with municipalities. As I mentioned, all municipalities have the fundamental starting point of secondary treatment. And for argument's sake here, I'm going to have three theoretical municipalities here who are all the same size. Therefore, what's coming out of their pipe is essentially the same. They have the same legal requirement, the same concentration of discharge after treatment. Obviously, the situation is that this municipality is discharging into a very large water body, so the relative near field, meaning around the pipe, impact of that municipality is going to be very different from this municipality who's on a much smaller stream segment. And this municipality who's in a little bit larger water body also has the advantage of what we call assimilative capacity. For argument's sake now, all three of these municipalities are discharging at their minimum level of treatment, and we don't have any water quality problems so far. Industries have the same, as I mentioned, categorical effluent limit. If these were three pulp mills, all three of them would have the same, let's say, organic pounds of organic loading that they can put out of their pipe for ton of production. Again, because of where they're located, this industry is discharging, like this municipality, into a large water body, this relative situation here. But on this smaller water body, now the cumulative effect of this municipality and this industry, even though they are discharging at legal levels, is that this stream now is seeing a water quality standard violation, let's say for dissolved oxygen. Well, what do we do about that? Well, what we would do if this was only two entities on this stream is we would write more stringent effluent limits for both of these facilities. Obviously, they both would be interested in who's relatively responsible for the problem, but in this situation, I think they both are. So they both would have essentially tighter effluent limits in their permit so that we bring this water body back to meeting standards. Now, let's say this municipality in the middle grows. There's more flow, more residences, more businesses, etc. The volume of their discharge now goes up, and the relative amount of pollution still goes up, but they still are controlled by this national categorical standard. For argument's sake, I'm saying that this, even though the volume and the amount of pollution discharged into this river system has gone up, it's still not enough to trigger a water quality standards violation. But we're now starting to get aware of the fact that this whole river system, particularly downstream from here, is getting a little bit more stressed. It's meeting standards, but it's getting a little closer to violating standards because of growth and cumulative impacts. Meanwhile, and we face this every day, remember that the Clean Water Act, the fundamental goal was eventually to get all water bodies with no discharge of pollutants eventually in this country, and to all water bodies to meet standards. What happens a lot is a new industry comes to town, and they're looking for a place to discharge. Now, obviously, there's a lot of variables in where an industry locates, not just the water situation, maybe water quantity. Do they have any water? Could be all sorts of various factors I know all of you are aware of. But with regard to water, one of the things that they may look for is that they are going to have a water discharge. Where should they locate? What's available to them? Well, in this hypothetical, this stream segment, until we issued limits, stringent limits is out of the question. There's no room for a new discharge here. We couldn't allow a new discharge. We could once the stream comes back to standards, but quite frankly, when we're dealing with these two entities, they're going to try to, in essence, minimize the amount that they have to invest in new treatment technology. They just want to meet the standard. They're not going to necessarily put in a huge infrastructure so that this stream now has a lot of assimilative capacity in it so that somebody else can come in and use it. That's just the reality of I think, that's a real-world situation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I fell asleep again, but the upper left, the one where it's brown, so they're meeting standards even though the amount of pollution there is of a higher proportion than the one that's down by the bigger stream. Am I understanding that correctly?
They were within their legal limits, but now that I put an industry and a municipality together, the cumulative discharge of both of them now exceeds the capacity of the stream to meet standards. So we have to go back to them, reopen their permits, and issue more stringent limitations that they will then have to meet to bring that water body back
Great.
To standards.
Thank you.
The Act has a provision called anti-degradation. What that means essentially is it's not an automatic given that a new discharger can come in and essentially pollute up to the standard just because there's room. There's a process that a new discharger would have to show that they absolutely, from an economic standpoint or socioeconomic standpoint, need to degrade the stream that otherwise was meeting standards or perhaps had no discharge at all. A very recent example of this was the Port Westward facility in St. Helens. Our commission, under our rules, has to approve any new or increased discharge of what is called a major permit, a major meaning a very large facility. The public policy question there is, if a new facility comes in, are you going to give them all of the remaining assimilative capacity in that stream, even though they'll still meet standards? What's at play here is if you give one entity all the assimilative capacity of the stream, what happens to the next one in the door? And they then are in this situation where there's no room there. So when you can imagine from, again, a public policy standpoint, not really a technical science issue, what's at play here is a fundamental question of, do you allow somebody in the here and now to use all the assimilative capacity of a stream, or do you want to reserve some for future growth? Either a municipality that might grow more or another industry that wants to come in a year from now who might want to locate on that river. So, you know, what I'm trying to depict here is these theoretical folks looking, kind of shopping for a place to discharge. They may want to go over to a stream that's relatively pristine because there's, you know, it's much different than this situation, but there still is a mechanism under the Clean Water Act that would not be an automatic that they could essentially use all that assimilative capacity in the stream.
Mike, what sort of economic factors play into that? I mean, I'm looking at where your weird little guys are there, and I'm saying, you know, that may be pristine up there. This is a separate question, but you've already said that where the municipality grew, they're reaching their limits, so you aren't going to allow somebody upstream from that to do something that will impact downstream. But, for example, your St. Helens example, if you have a... I guess it would be short-term versus long-term sort of thing, but if you have an economically depressed area and this is a business coming in that will have a significant economic impact on the community, would your commission be more inclined to allow them to go closer to the bar as opposed to a community that's already vital and it's another piece being added?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. And using the Port Westward example, they did approve the increase in discharge for Port Westward. And I think they were, I can't speak for the commission, obviously, or any individual member in terms of what they were thinking about it. But it was very much a part of the presentation of the economic situation of Columbia County. Okay. And I think for the what I sense from the commission is what they wanted to hear was, can this facility be located and still meet water quality standards in the Columbia River? The answer was yes. yes. As a matter of fact, they were a very de minimis impact on the stream. And I think they were very moved by the fact that this is an economically depressed part of the state. So they did approve that allowance of that new discharge of that stream system.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krupp.
In that regard, Mike.
Is that right? Good point.
Thank you. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. I sort of have this circumstance in the North Sandy Am Canyon area in House District 17, which is Staten up to Detroit Lake. Severely economically depressed area. I had the North Sandy Am Economic Development Corporation in my office yesterday talking about this very thing, so timely that we chat about with. They have had specifically two businesses, one of which was a business that was a window manufacturer that was going to bring 150 jobs to the area that wanted to locate and could not because of the discharge issue. Now, this is perhaps a bit different than normal, but it does really play into your visual here in that the city of Salem obtains its water from Staten, from the North Sandy Am at a point right above the city of Staten. And it transverses all the way into Salem here by means of canal. They were unable to locate any of these businesses in the last 2 or 3 years in the canyon area because of the consideration of discharge and how it may affect the city of Salem's water quality. And they say this has something to do with the three basin rule. Correct. Would you explain what that is and then what potential there would be to mitigate and allow some economic development in an area that is in utter decline?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'd be glad to. It predates me in terms of the dynamics that went around the three basin rule. I'll give you what I know, and I'd be glad to provide a more specific follow-up if necessary to you. The three basin rule was adopted, I believe, sometime in the mid-1990s, and it was driven, just as you say, by the fact that particular river was essentially the water supply for the city of Salem. There's a mechanism in the clean, as I talked earlier about designating uses of waters and associated criteria, there is a mechanism in the Clean Water Act where, by rule and standards, a water body could be essentially protected from any further discharges into the system, which is essentially what the three basin rule does. It essentially locks out new surface water discharges to that river system because of the driver of the public health concerns of the water supply and Salem's needs. One of the potential issues is to look at whether or not they actually need a surface water discharge. There may be options where they could look at a land application, if they assuming they have a water discharge as a part of their production. Now, I recognize that in some cases that's not feasible if you're dealing with extremely high volumes of water. Basically putting it into some type of a septic tank or on-site system may be technically infeasible. I don't know the situation in terms of a more traditional land application like an irrigation system that would be an option. I'm aware of the fact that even land application makes some people nervous in that basin because it just concerns of eventually the groundwater could still come back, and if it's polluted it can get into the water body. But that's the situation as I understand it. Representative Krupp.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. It seems that the city of Detroit, because of this issue, which is in kind of a basically a septics, kind of a common septic, they would like to put in a water treatment facility. And it's, you know, the city of Detroit's a rather small, very, very small community. And it seems that the bill is exceeding well over $20 million to do that. It seems to be just extraordinarily excessive for us to be able to allow a community like Detroit to be able to have any expansion, anything other than a tourist industry, to provide economic stability. How are we going to address that in light of the three-basin rule? And what ability is there to mitigate the effects of the three-basin rule or, in fact, remove it? And is it removable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, it's clearly removable. It's a public policy. It's an issue that was put into rule by the commission. You know, the various mechanisms, including petitions for rulemaking to the commission, that can be pressed ahead. You know, obviously, there was a long history with that, and I imagine that there will be people on all sides of that issue. But it's not an immovable object. It's you know, it's a public policy debate that certainly the commission could take up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, on the up there on the brown stream, the polluted one, as the municipality and as time goes on and the municipality and the industry, either because they're complying with some kind of regulation or they're just good stewards of their environment, whichever, they've reached the max at that point. Then as time goes on, their technology or their desire to stop putting stuff in there, they invest in that, and that amount goes down.
Yes.
Now, they're off limits for further development now, but as that amount goes down, would that open up room for jobs just like Mr. Representative Krupp's talking about? Or once they're on this list, no matter what they do, it stays the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, no, that if they went below their limits and there was, again, assimilative capacity in the stream, there would be provisions for somebody else to use that. Mm-hmm. This is where, and I don't want to get us too far off track, we could talk about effluent trading at some point, which is a market-driven mechanism where perhaps they would invest in the infrastructure and essentially sell their capacity to somebody else. That's EPA is promoting that once again. No doubt, however, there would be some folks who would say, well, now that the rivers, again, the Clean Water Act was supposed to get all the pollution out, so now that we've made a great progress and we've gotten some of it out of the river, let's not go back to just meeting the standard again. So again, it would be, you know, there would be a debate about that. But from a legal perspective, yes, that freed up room is available for somebody else to use.
And I don't think it's off track at all.
Yeah.
I really, finding wiggle room to create jobs is a good idea now. That's all I, that's what I think.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Mike, later in your presentation, are you going to deal with what opportunities there may be for communities who are facing these types of circumstances to obtain the financial help to be able to comply so that they can grow and, in fact, survive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I didn't build into this presentation anything about financial assistance. I'd be glad to talk about it, though. I certainly can.
Well, would you?
Right now?
Sure.
Be glad to.
Since we're on the subject.
All right. Well, one of the things that we do is when the Clean Water Act was adopted in the early 70s, Congress appropriated billions of dollars for municipal infrastructure, and it was a grant program. A lot of municipalities in the state of Oregon probably either built their first treatment plant or upgraded an old plant using federal funds that were grants that were anywhere from 50% to 100%. In the mid-1980s, Congress changed that grant program and turned it into a loan program, which is called the State Revolving Fund that we administer. It's a perpetual fund. Congress still gives about $15 million a year to Oregon. We match it with bonds. We loan the money out. It's extremely low interest rates right now. It's about 1% for anywhere from 5 to 20 years, although we're opening that up to even a 40-year term. And when the principal and interest is repaid back, we loan the money right back out again. So we're now revolving about $50 to $60 million a year. That keeps going up because now we're really starting to see that revenue stream from the early loans coming in. We anticipate in the next 4 to 5 years we may have around $80 to $90 million a year in loans. Now, obviously, what I hear a lot from municipalities is they prefer a grant than a loan. We do not have the availability to give grants to communities, but certainly 1% loan for 40 years might be at least an opportunity for municipalities. We also have staff that work with like the community solutions team that bring we partner with other agencies. There's a lot of USDA programs that provide, particularly for rural communities, grant money to build treatment plants. So we participate with a lot of other agencies on what we kind of call one-stop shopping for municipalities to come in and help them kind of look around for the best deal or leverage money. Maybe they can get a little bit of a grant from or a loan from us and a grant from a USDA agency, and we help them try to package their needs.
And Mr. Chair, if I may
follow,
does not Oregon Economic Community Development also assist in this regard?
Yes, they do, Mr. Cobb.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we work quite closely with them as well on that one-stop shopping mechanism.
Thank you.
I think we're going to get tight on time, Mike, and
right.
I specifically want to get to the House information.
Okay.
So, if you would help us a little.
I will try to run through as fast as I can. Kind of completing the graphics here, non-point sources of pollution, as I mentioned, started to become more of an issue in the 1980s. Obviously, and if we have a situation where maybe there's a stream, and this will actually get into the Haas discussion, if we do have a stream that is impaired in terms of not meeting water quality standards because of non-point source pollution, it still is a violation of water quality standards. What I wanted to point out here, by using a watershed example, is that the way that we look at watersheds is we try to look as broadly as we can. We try to take into consideration all this stuff that's going on. And when you have a water quality standards problem, a lot of times we're not finger pointing at this individual or this timber operation or this farmer. It typically is a cumulative impact problem in the watershed. And what TMDLs do is try to figure out the most equitable way of getting these water bodies back to meeting standards, but also acknowledging the fact that the pollution is coming from multiple sources. Very quickly, somebody mentioned the issue of the gray area between point and non-point. This is some case law recently that you may have heard about that is making the definitions a lot thornier. You may have heard about the Talent Irrigation or the Forest Green decision. Basically, these are court rulings that said if you apply an aquatic herbicide to kill weeds in an irrigation system, you need an NPDES permit. That was not something DEQ pursued, by the way. It came out of case law. Recently, the Forest Green decision has to do with the same phenomenon. If you're using helicopters to spray like BT for gypsy moth or other types of pests, that by the court's definition is a discrete conveyance and you need an NPDES permit. So we actually have the Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service coming to us now asking for a permit to use a helicopter spray. Suction dredge mining, we issued a permit about 10 years ago. This is the operation of these little suction devices that go across the stream. Actually, in that situation, it was the miners themselves that came to us and said they wanted protection from a third-party lawsuit, so they wanted a permit. Have that kind of gray area stuff. And we also mentioned stormwater. I was going to talk quickly about TMDLs. This is the 303D list, as I mentioned. These are river miles in the state that are on the 303D list. As I mentioned previously, this is about 10% of the state's river miles. It's about 13. This can be additive, by the way. You can have a water body that's on the list both for temperature and, let's say, DO. So the total miles, don't add all those up. The total miles in the state is about 13,000. Some of those water bodies are on for multiple pollutants. A TMDL is basically a process that determines the amount of pollution that a water body can assimilate and still meet standards. And then we try to figure out how much has to be reduced from current loadings and who needs to do it. This looks pretty fancy, but it's just basically the equation of a TMDL. What a TMDL is, ultimately, is how much load are you going to give to point sources, how much is described to non-point sources, how much is natural background that we do take into consideration. Depending on the analytical rigor of the TMDL, we can build in sort of a conservancy factor. And as we already talked about, TMDLs typically, from a public policy standpoint, the people that are there today want to get as much of the load as they can, but we try to make sure that when we're talking to our advisory committees that you think about future growth. If you give away all the assimilative capacity to all the existing dischargers today and they still meet standards, there may be no room for future growth. So we put that public policy issue on the table when we're working with our advisory committee so that they make a conscious choice about giving away the assimilative capacity to people who are there today or whether they want to bank some for future growth. How do we do TMDLs? We try to do them in the largest scale possible. We do whole basins because, frankly, a lot of the, even though there may be site-specific situations that are causing water quality problems, we try to make sure we're looking at the entire watershed. We look at all the pollutants at one time. The worst thing that we could do to a public works director is to come in with a temperature limit today and they start building infrastructure, and then we come back to them 3 years later and we say, oh, now we've got to talk to you about dissolved oxygen. We try to give them everything that they need so that they can comprehensively deal with the pollution problem. The same thing for non-point sources. We don't want to talk just about temperature and then 3 years from now go back and talk to them about sediment, particularly if what they can do to deal with that problem is the same solution. This is just a map, an example of the Tualatin. We deal both with point sources and non-point sources at the same time. We try to use the best science possible. We are using this FLIR technology to look at temperature, which is basically the infrared process where you fly a helicopter over a stream. We've been criticized, obviously, for just doing grab samples to look at temperature in a stream. You may not, if you only took a grab sample here and one over here, you may not have any idea of what's going on in between. FLIR technology allows you to take a very nice snapshot of a stream. What's interesting here, this is the Williamson River and the Spring Creek. What it actually shows, if you look at the coloration here, it shows the influence of Spring Creek, which is very cold, and you can see how this black part, which is less than 50 degrees, carries on through the system and then eventually dissipates down here. It'd be very difficult to figure that out if you're not using a technology like this. But it provides, I think, better credibility to the science of how we're dealing with things like temperature. We work on TMDLs. We partner with as many people as possible. We work with watershed councils, environmental groups, federal agency, land management agencies, citizens. We have advisory committees that we sit down and spend literally years with. Sorry that got cut off. This is just the map that you may have seen many times of our TMDL schedule. This came out of the Oregon plan in 1997. This is a schedule we're on to get done with the TMDLs by 2007. Obviously, and you may want to talk about this at a later date. What's at play now is the budget situation. We've cut 10 FTEs in the TMDL program recently. So the trade-off we have is, do we stay on schedule but do TMDLs with less data, less analytical rigor, but get them done on time, or do we extend the schedule to make sure we do them the way that we have been doing them? One of the dilemmas there is extending the schedule may open up a federal consent decree that we have as a result of litigation, and Richard Whitman may talk about that when he gets up here in a moment. Again, you can read this at your leisure, but this is just how do we involve others and what are the issues that we look at in a TMDL. Again, wanting to stress the issue of reserve capacity for future growth. Implementation of the TMDL is done through various mechanisms. DEQ actually is not in the lead on all implementation. If there's an agricultural issue, the implementation mechanism is a 10-10 plan. If there's forestry issues, the implementation mechanism is through the Forest Practices Act. If it's a permit issue, obviously we are the agency that deals and has a delegation and authority to deal with permitting. As I mentioned to Representative Cruz, with federal agencies, we have some memorandums of agreement that we try to at least get BLM and U.S. Forest Service to step up and do their share if they're part of the problem. Let me close with this, adaptive management. It's a term that we've used a lot. This is a little example that a colleague of mine came up with, and I thought it was pretty good. And I'll use the temperature standard as the exact issue, since it tends to be the one that people focus on anyway. for argument's sake, let's say that this axis is temperature. And this is where we are today in terms of the stream temperature. This is the standard that we're at today. Oh, I'm sorry, this is the standard that we're shooting for. And this is time. What's going on, of course, is people are arguing about this line. Is the temperature standard too warm or too cold? Is it inaccurate, etc.? Not in some situations, some people will say, given that regardless of the debate over where this line should ultimately be driven, there is some acknowledgement that perhaps temperature is a little bit too high in these streams. We ought to do something about it. But I think what happens is we obviously get into gridlock, where people want to get resolution of this standard before we move off of dead center. Adaptive management says, let's start trying to deal with, in this case, reversing the warming trend in the stream. Let's start getting the temperature down, and maybe let's just get it down to, let's say this is 80 degrees. Let's get the stream down to 75 in 5 years. This still is going to be playing out in terms of what the temperature standard should ultimately be. It shouldn't stop this glide slope from getting down. If it goes up, then we get there sooner. If it goes down, it may take more time. But adaptive management means to me that we recognize that maybe the science around temperature is not 100% accurate. Maybe it means that the steps people are taking are unknown. They don't know if their best management practices are going to work. And we try to build that into the TMDL and say, in 5 years, we're going to come back and revisit where we are in that TMDL. If we got the standard wrong, we'll fix it. We did that in the Tualatin. We changed the phosphorus loadings because of better information. If what you tried on the land didn't work, we're not going to penalize you for that because you tried something and maybe the best management practices are changing and you can try something else. So we try to avoid a situation where we just create gridlock because people are arguing over the standard still, or people are arguing over how long it might take to put things into effect. So I know that you want to get on, Mr. Chair, with other issues, so I think I'll stop there.
If I could just make one point on that, because temperature clearly is incredibly controversial, but if we're saying that the temperature needs to come down and we ought to start moving on it when we haven't, we don't even necessarily know how to move on it. For example, are we taking into full consideration ambient air and ground temperatures? I've seen studies that show that we shouldn't be measuring temperature at this point of the stream. We should be measuring temperature of that same piece of water as it moves through the system, which we aren't doing, which would allow us to see if what is happening in the riparian area with canopy and stuff like that is really having impact. So I guess I'd have a little bit of an argument there that we should be trying to fix something when we don't, A, always know if it's fixable, and B, know if the practices we have in place are the ones that are really going to get us there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I don't know how to. I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with the premise. I do, as you know. I mean, there's so many voices on the temperature standard on both sides. I mean, there's people who clearly believe that 64 degrees was way too warm, and people who have just the opposite opinion. We are in the midst. EPA is in the midst of reevaluating the temperature standard because of dynamics in the Pacific Northwest. We are going to be reopening the temperature standard because of that process, and are going to be doing a tremendous amount of outreach with people to put all these issues back on the table as necessary, again, to update the science. The question to me, though, Representative Cruz, is will the ultimate conclusion of that, assuming we can get there with consensus, is it going to change the temperature standard way up here so that nothing really needs to get done, or are we going to be talking about maybe some marginal changes? And in the middle of that, should we still have a situation where you have streams that maybe are a couple of months of the year are at, you know, 78, 79, 80 degrees. Can't we move ahead and at least start trying to deal with those localized situations while this debate still plays out underneath? I think that's the real public policy choice that we're facing.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I understand that, but the point is, if the tools in the toolbox are not going to get us from point A to point B, for example, if canopy isn't going to reduce water temperature, and I think in a lot of cases we'll probably find it doesn't, You know, so we're putting all this effort into riparian plantings to try to achieve canopy in 15 years that's really not going to have the desired impact. I guess the point is, going ahead is fine, but if we're going ahead in the wrong direction, you know, we're putting a lot of money into something that, you know, riparian planting for soil stabilization and things like that, absolutely appropriate, but I'm not sure that canopy is maybe one of the objectives we should be getting, especially on the east side. So, I mean, it's just, when you say this is still being debated, but we're going to move ahead, that's fine, but the question still is how we're going to move ahead.
Other questions? You've done very well, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who we got? Good afternoon, or good morning, I guess, yet, Mr. Whitman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today to give you an update on some litigation coming out of Baker County in the eastern part of the state. The name of the case is Hawes versus the State of Oregon. And what I'm going to do, I have no prepared remarks today. I'm happy to answer questions as we go along. I'm going to give you a brief overview of what the litigation is about and what the current status of the litigation is. The lawsuit was brought in Baker County Circuit Court, and it's a challenge to the state's authority to enter into a memorandum of agreement with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency that calls for or sets out a schedule for adoption and implementation of TMDLs in the state of Oregon. The court, Baker County Circuit Court, held in a decision in December that the state did not have authority to enter into the memorandum of agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency to the extent that that agreement requires adoption or implementation of TMDLs on streams or stream segments that are affected only by non-point source pollution. That's a mouthful. And let me pause there if there are questions about that. So the court's order goes to the ability to carry out that memorandum of agreement only to the extent that it's directed at streams that are affected only by non-point source pollution.
So just to be clear, the decision was that narrow so that if it would not allow an exclusion of non-point in a stream that had point source. If the stream has point source, everything's still included in TMDL.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz. That's our understanding of the judgment from the Circuit Court. All right. Notices of appeal have been filed in the case, essentially by everybody involved, including the plaintiffs who have filed notices of appeal. The state and defendant interveners, several environmental organizations, have also filed notices of appeal. The defendant intervener environmental organizations in the state have also moved for a stay of the court's judgment pending the appeal. That stay motion is being briefed before the Baker County Circuit Court right now, and there is a hearing scheduled on the stay motion for March 13th. Basically, we're expecting that there will be a decision from the Oregon Court of Appeals in this case sometime probably this fall of this year. And that's essentially the status of the case. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about it.
Are there questions?
I did ask Ms. Halleck a question, Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you. No, they were these Hawes folks, they disagreed with the fact that they could make the agreement, or they disagreed with the amount that was in the TMDL, or both, or neither.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, my understanding is that the plaintiffs, the Hawes and others, disagree with the authority of the Department of Environmental Quality to enter into the agreement, at least as it pertains to, again, to streams affected only by non-point sources. They're not, the plaintiffs have, are not challenging a particular TMDL or an amount of an allocation that's been made, because as, you would have had to be looking quickly at Mr. Llewellyn's map as it went by, but the TMDL for the Burnt and Powder River Basin is not scheduled to be adopted until 2005. So that's not an issue. It's the general authority to enter into this agreement.
Follow?
Would it be safe to assume that the genesis of this is whether or not EPA has authority to regulate non-point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, as some of you probably know, there is litigation going on elsewhere in the country on this issue. And there has been a challenge to the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency to require TMDLs on streams and stream segments that are affected only by non-point sources. That's the Pronsolino case in the Ninth Circuit coming from California. And the Ninth Circuit has held in that case that EPA does have authority to require that TMDLs be established on stream segments affected only by non-point source pollution. There may be there still could be a motion for reconsideration en banc in the Ninth Circuit. There still could be an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in that case, so it's not final yet. But we have a decision for now from the Ninth Circuit panel that EPA, in fact, did have the authority. One thing that people get confused by is there are really two main issues here in terms of authority. One is the authority to require that a TMDL be established. That's in the TMDL is the allocation. It's setting the numbers, what goes to point sources, what goes to non-point sources, what goes to background, what goes to reserve capacity. That's what's at issue in the Pronsolino case, the authority to require that a TMDL be established. There is then a second question, which is what are the authorities for, if you will, implementation plans that determine for non-point sources how you're going to achieve that load allocation. That's a separate issue. That issue is not directly at issue in the Pronsolino litigation in the Ninth Circuit. That issue, and frankly, it's not clear the extent to which that's at issue in the Hawes litigation.
Mr. Chair, I just know that knowledgeable people reading the Clean Water Act have said that EPA is exceeding authority, and I think that's probably the genesis for both of these lawsuits.
Yes,
is to make that determination. Just as a side issue, is there a court that's been overturned more than nine in recent history?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think you're well aware that the statistics are that the Ninth Circuit has a relatively high rate of being reversed by the Supreme Court. But we are part of the Ninth Circuit. We operate within the Ninth Circuit. So when we have a decision from the Ninth Circuit, it's something that we have to, particularly when it's on a matter of federal law, follow.
Well, Ms. Sharon, I fully understand that, but I guess the point is a decision by nine isn't necessarily the final word on anything anymore. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's exactly right, and that's why I pointed out that an appeal is still possible in that case.
Representative Krupp. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard
Could you recite for us the reasoning that was stated in the circuit court ruling as to why they ruled in favor of the plaintiff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'll try. The reasoning is, with all respect to the court, fairly brief. The court focused on two particular Oregon statutes, ORS 468B110 and ORS 468B035.
Oh, it's amazing you remember
that. And the court went through essentially a textual analysis of those two statutes and basically determined that those two statutes give DEQ authority to do what's necessary to carry out the federal Water Pollution Control Act, the Clean Water Act. And it then determined that the Clean Water Act, Federal Clean Water Act, does not require TMDLs on these types of streams that are affected only by non-point sources. That was the basic analysis of the circuit court.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Schaffer. Thank you. Comment or question. If I live to see the final word on any issue in my life, I'll be happy. Just one. But that's not the question is, what do the Haws do? What kind of impact will this decision, either way it goes, have on their lives, their business, their communities? What brought them to court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm not the trial attorney in this case, but based on what I've seen of the record, my understanding is that the Haws are ranchers in Baker County, have a prominent role on the County Farm Bureau, and their concern is that if, as I understand it, if a TMDL were established on the streams around where they ranch, they would be required to plant trees, fence the riparian area, and do other things that would cost them a significant amount of money. And that is the harm to them individually that they alleged would result from this memorandum of agreement.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Crump.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the DOJ, the state of Oregon, involved in, or were you involved in the original decision in terms of filing a brief on behalf of the state of Oregon in the circuit court? And were you involved in the Ninth Circuit Court decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we were involved in the Haws decision. We were the defendant, so yeah, we filed a brief defending the state in circuit court, and on the Pronsolino case, I'm trying to remember. There was a friend of the court brief in that case filed by the state of California Attorney General's office. And I believe that we signed on to that friend of the court brief in the Pronsolino case in the Ninth Circuit.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, what is the state's argument as to why they would sign on to the Pronsolino case? What's your basic argument there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there's a federal district court decision in the Pronsolino case also from several years ago now, which goes through a very lengthy analysis of the authority of its basis for its belief, that district court, that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has the authority to require TMDLs on non-point source only streams. We reviewed that district court opinion carefully. We reviewed the brief, the friend of the court brief that was prepared by the California Attorney General's office in the Ninth Circuit appeal, and we agree with their analysis. We believe that EPA does have the authority under Section 303D and Section 303E of the Clean Water Act to require TMDLs on non-point source only streams. Basically, for the reasons set forth in both the district court opinion and now the Ninth Circuit Court's opinion in that case.
Mr. Chair, now let me be clear on what you just said, and I know your profession is being an attorney and being very careful in your language. Does that ruling or does that appeal that you signed on to state that the state does have the authority? I'm talking about the federal district court ruling. Do you agree then that the federal district court ruling says the states have the authority to enter into MOUs? That's not what you're saying.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that is not what I'm saying.
Okay.
And that's why I paused a little while ago to say there are two issues here. One is the issue to require that a TMDL be completed for a particular water body. That's the numeric allocation. That's what's at issue in the Pronsolino case. And we agree with the position that EPA has taken and that the Ninth Circuit has now taken, that, and the State of California has taken, that there is authority to require TMDLs to be established on non-point source only streams under the Federal Clean Water Act. But there's a second issue, which is, which you ask, is the whether the Federal Clean Water Act authorizes the state to enter into this MOU that it did in the state of Oregon. That's what's at issue in the Hawes case, slightly different issue than Pronsolino. And there we took the position in the trial court that the Federal Clean Water Act is a source of authority for entering into that memorandum of agreement. It's not the only source of authority. There are state statutory authorities as well.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, one last question, if I may.
Sure.
Again, reiterate for my very short memory, where are we on the Hawes case, and what is your involvement in that, any potential legal further action?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, status of the case is trial court issued its decision in December. Notices of appeal have been filed by all the parties. So it's before the Oregon Court of Appeals, and I don't believe the trial court record has been filed with the Court of Appeals yet. So briefing will start in the Oregon Court of Appeals sometime in the next 30 to 60 days. So we are a party to that appeal along with everybody else, and at the same time, we are also, along with the environmental organizations that intervened in the case, seeking a stay of the trial court's decision. And right now, we're seeking that stay before the trial court in Baker County.
Representative Johnson, please. These requirements that the Hawes are afraid of, are they currently law or other ranchers required to follow them right now, or is this all on hold until this decision is made? And if they lose, how much money are we talking about here for them to comply with these rules around their streams running through their ranch?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, Mr. Llewellyn in his presentation pointed out that the implementation of the TMDLs is done largely through other programs. In this case, I believe we would be looking at the Department of Agriculture's 1010 program.
Mm-hmm.
The 1010 program, there are 1010 plans, as you probably know, in many basins, but not all basins around the state. And as a general matter, there are differences from plans to plan, and those plans are developed with the active involvement of local entities. But as a general matter, those plans do not require anything in terms of anything that's enforceable within at least the first 2 years of plan adoption. There's a 2-year grace period, if you will, after adoption of the plan for essentially an educational voluntary effort to go into place. And to my knowledge, none of the plans have explicit requirements in terms of tree planting or even fencing. Instead, what they have are essentially performance standards, which say there are certain types of conditions that you can't let develop. And it leaves it up to the property owner to decide how to avoid those prohibited conditions. So that's sort of the basic thrust of the 10-10 program. So we're, I think, in I don't want to speak for the Department of Agriculture, but I think, as a general matter, those plans don't require the types of specific activities that the plaintiffs in this case are concerned about. Now, you also asked about the cost of tree planting and fencing. I think those costs could be substantial, based on the allegations by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. I don't remember the exact figures, but they're substantial costs.
Please, one more.
Following. Do the hogs have just? Do they just have cattle range and out in the pasture? Or is this a confined feedlot right next to a creek or a river?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I don't know the answer to that.
Representative Schaffler, I think it's pasture land that we're dealing with here. I think we get into a CAFO sort of thing. I believe you're probably looking at more of a point source pollution that we'd probably be looking at in that.
Just a
couple of things that just
whenever
tonight. Basically, it's fair to say that this is a test case. Is that right? It was actually filed by the Agricultural Legal Foundation on behalf of the Haws. A lot of concern, I think, around the state on this issue, and therefore a need to have the courts clarify, you know, part of where it is. And I believe, sir, that the once a 10-10 plan has been adopted, there's a year to proof up on. I thought I heard you say 2 years. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Mr. Chair, you may well be correct. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krupp.
Just quickly, why is the state of Oregon seeking a stay? What's the implications of not having a stay granted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the first thing I'd point out on that is that the interveners have filed separate stay motions. So even if the state were not seeking a stay at this point, it's going to be before the court one way or the other.
I'm looking for the philosophical reason.
I think the concern is that the court's judgment is worded in a way that is not real clear and could be interpreted broadly and could interfere with essentially the schedule that Mr. Llewellyn put up for adoption of TMDLs around the state and could therefore interfere with our consent decree in another earlier piece of litigation where the state was party to a consent decree that requires that these things be done within a certain time period. So that's sort of the general philosophical reason.
And the implication, Mr. Chair, if I may, the implication of not being granted the stay would be from your legal perspective.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the implication would be a possible delay in final adoption of some PMDLs for a period probably, well, until the Court of Appeals makes a decision on the appeal.
Thank you. Representative Cruz.
Yeah, just kind of trying to clarify things in my own mind, points of authority. I think it's fairly clear for most folks that while EPA may have the authority to require TMDLs, they don't have the authority to regulate non-point. That falls to the states if indeed the states choose to do it. Would I be correct in my sense that without 1010 that authority currently resides with DEQ and 1010 shifts that authority to Department of Ag, or does DEQ not have that authority currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, it is a tough question. I think that DEQ continues to have authority over regulation of non-point source pollution.
Even with 1010?
Even with 1010. But I guess I would characterize, and I'm sort of giving you a high-level view here. I guess I would say that the Department of Agriculture has primary authority.
I mean, DEQ is always the backstop on anything, right. Anything environmental. Obviously, I mean, the relationship is direct with EPA there, but so DEQ, it's one of the issues that has come up all through 1010 is that why are we doing this? And the answer is it's already there. We're just trying to shift it into a different camp, more or less. So because DEQ clearly has the authority to regulate, and we're trying to do it in a more, don't take offense by this, a more user-friendly type approach to an agency the landowners are used to working with, sort of thing. So would that be a pretty fair characterization, you think?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's certainly the way that I've heard it characterized commonly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Floyd.
Thank you. Mr. Whitman, you indicated earlier there was an extensive cost that would likely be involved in bringing the numbers of tree plantings and fencing and things to the Haas and the other people. Is that then directly related to the number of stream miles that are on all of this open range land in eastern Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I want to be real clear about what I said. I said that the Haas had alleged a significant cost from tree planting and fencing. I think it's an open question, you know, what the actual cost of carrying out 1010 plans will be. So again, I think looking at those costs is something that the Department of Agriculture considers as it develops 1010 plans and 1010 rules for each basin. And again, a sort of main part of that process is working with farmers and ranchers in each basin to figure out what is doable, if you will. And this gets back to Mr. Llewellyn's point about adaptive management, sort of what steps can and or should be taken to get things started.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I love legal stuff, don't you, Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, and with that, we have concluded our agenda for today, and we are adjourned.